when I reached out to you to talk about Fleetwood Mac and the concert that you reviewed in 1975, you said in your response to me, you've thought about the review on occasion over the years because band's music easily and quickly forgotten was the headline on October 27th, 1975 in the Daily Campus. And the last
I don't write the headlines, Ken.
And the last line was, unfortunately, Fleetwood Mac and Renaissance are not as significant bands as they could be. They just don't think hard enough. That was a very straightforward review to conclude with, but it's what a reviewer would do. Had you known a lot about the band beforehand, as well as Renaissance, which was a prog rock band that opened for them, or was this really your first dive into the music, hearing it for the first time live?
I would not characterize myself as the world's most fervent Fleetwood Mac fan. I was aware of them, certainly, because they'd been a band for many, many years. And I would venture to say that I was mildly interested in them when they were a British blues rock band. And Peter Green was in the band and so forth. Over time, they had various iterations of the lineup. People came and went. And as it grew closer to the year 1975, which is under discussion between us, they had that horrific ensemble that had Welch in it. And I could characterize me as wholly disinterested in Fleetwood Mac just prior to when Buckingham and Nicks joined them.
Bob Welch was the singer, guitarist, and songwriter that they really needed because Fleetwood and Mac, they were the drummer and the bass player. They didn't write. They didn't sing. Christine Perfect, before she came into the band, then became Christine McVie, was another songwriter and another voice. But when Welch decided to go solo, that's when they were kind of stuck. And eventually they got Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks into the band, which became Fleetwood Mac number 10 under the Rock Family Trees listing by Pete Frame, which came out many years ago, that sort of showed the ins and outs that you referred to with all the bands that they had. They had 1, 2, 3, 4. They had like 5 different guitar players before version 10.
Yeah, that was 10. Really... Iteration number 10, that's incredible. You know, no wonder I was not, very interested at that point. But, what's interesting about them is clearly after toiling away, for years and years and years, they found themselves moving more and more toward what you would call pop music as opposed to their British blues, because I'm sure they thought it's about time we earned a living.
It was kind of a short time frame looking back at their history, which you referred to with Peter Green. My recollection, it was originally Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac after Fleetwood had worked in a bunch of bands. McVie had been in a bunch of bands, and Fleetwood and Green were kind of together in lots of different places, ultimately going to the Blues Breakers with John Mayall, and eventually they all split up and came in and out of other bands. So it was really only about a 10-year cycle of bouncing around between other bands before they all came together in 1975 when they really came together with the final version of the band. But it went through those iterations over the previous 4 or 5 years, which I think, because I certainly wasn't aware of it much myself back then, and I was starting to write about music as a newspaper reporter during that time period. So it was kind of confusing.
Well, they hadn't penetrated the American market too deeply, But you're right, they did come out of that whole British blues tradition that included John Mayall and Graham Bond and that whole crowd. And that's where Mick Jagger and Keith Richard came out of as well, and Brian Jones.
Well, Mayall had a lot of those guys in his bands over the years, and then they eventually split out into their own bands over the years. And the Stones were pretty much the only ones that held together more than most. Most people don't recognize the fact that, with very few exceptions, the Stones, to a certain extent, the Beatles, only made one change after Pete Best was replaced by Ringo. Most bands evolve over the years. REM, U2 are very exceptional in that sense of guys that found themselves together and wanted to make music together, and they stuck together. Whereas yeah. everybody, you know, as soon as the lead singer thought that he or she could go away, boom, and the band broke up.
Yeah, you're right about that. But Fleetwood Mac was sort of kind of a bunch of journeymen, you know, coming and going. And by the way, when you say their final iteration with Buckingham and Nix, it wasn't their final iteration, because after that, they replaced those two with Rick Vito and somebody else. And then finally, the last tour they did, Mike Campbell was the guitar player.
I tend to forget those things when I'm looking at these yeah. books that I have. But you're correct. And they made their peace with each other. And then there was, you know, the internal dynamics of that band, you almost broke them up earlier than that. And then with the passing of Christine McVie, that's pretty much, it's over at this point, I think.
Well, nothing lasts forever, as we'll find out.
Well, you've spent your career in the music business, which I was not aware of. What was your track after you got out of UConn and started working? I know you started writing a lot and then became involved as an artist and repertoire guy at the labels. Take me through your interest in music when you were young and how that played out over the beginning of your career.
When I was a youngster, I discovered something that, you know, was very, very interesting to me, which is that if you wrote about records, they would send them to you for free. And because I had a voracious appetite for records and I couldn't nearly afford all that I wanted, I set about trying to figure out, you know, how to write for publications and therefore make a claim to these free records that would come in the mail. I did that all through high school and into college. After college, because I was involved with the industry through being a writer, I got to know publicists and so forth at all the major record labels. There was an indie publicist named Howard Bloom. And Howard Bloom, there was no writer on the planet Earth that wasn't made of gold as far as Howard Bloom was concerned. So the kid from the New Haven Register and various other publications was just as important to him as the editor-in-chief of Rolling Stone. And so he always stayed in contact with me and befriended me and this and that. And when I got out of college, he did offer me a job as a publicist. Howard Bloom was known as the sweatshop of publicity. It was a very difficult environment to work. So I hold the record, I'm proud to say, for getting in and out of the Howard Bloom organization in record time, because at some point after about 10 months, Columbia Records called and asked me would I like to join their publicity department, which I did. And I'm trying to give you the fast thumbnail version. I'm not telling you every colorful story I could, but what happened was there was a woman in the Columbia Records publicity department who got engaged to the senior vice president of the Columbia Records promotion department. Concurrent with that, the promotion guy got offered the job as the president of Mercury Records. And when that happened, he rang me up and asked me, would I want to be the director of A&R, artists and repertoire at Mercury Records? It didn't take me more than a millisecond to say yes to that offer. So I became the director of A&R and started scouting talent and signing acts and supervising recordings and so forth. I worked at Mercury Records for about 8 years. I got drafted into service at Elektra Records, and I worked there for another 5 or 6 years. Eventually went back to Mercury Records for a few more years. So when you meet an A&R guy, you're supposed to say, oh yeah, who have you signed? That's your cue, Ken.
Well, I know you signed a lot of big names. So who did you sign?
Well, I'll try and rattle them off expeditiously. The first couple, I got really lucky, and I didn't sign them in their first foray into record making, but I did sign the Moody Blues and then Peter Gabriel. which helped me keep my job for many years. And then I signed a group called the Rainmakers. I did three albums with the Everly Brothers. I signed Robert Cray and Michelle Schacht. And at that point, after Cray, I signed Robert Cray, and he sold many millions of records, and that made me a very hot commodity on the A&R market, and that's when Elektra came calling. And at Elektra, I signed the Pixies and the Breeders, and had a hand in They Might Be Giants and others.
Well, when there's too many to remember, that means that you've been in the business and very successful, because you can't remember all that. When I did see that you had involvement with Robert Cray, I went to my shelf of recordings and pulled out a couple and found on my favorite album, A Strong Persuader, there's an acknowledgement of you in the liner notes. So I play that record all the time.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it. See, that makes me happy. Yeah, Robert, I came across him. He was on an independent label called High Tone Records, and I took a liking to the albums he was making there. And then so I ventured out on a stormy, rainy night, drove up to Providence, Rhode Island, and I saw him third on the bill at a club there. He was third on the bill to John Hammond Jr. and John Lee Hooker. But Robert was, you know, spectacular. And all I could think of was, I got to have that voice on my label, that voice on my label. There was quite a lot of dispute about whether signing, a blues act was really a sensible business maneuver. But I did keep my eye on the ball, and I kept saying, no, I got to have that. And ultimately it worked out great, you know. And he was on the cover of Rolling Stone. And the headline was The Blues Are Back and He's the Boss. And everything just went great with that project.
In your time in the industry, things have changed significantly, of course. We're now in the extreme digital age. They just brought back album covers as part of the Grammys, which hadn't been around for 53 years. In your mind, how have things evolved, and what were the things that made the major impacts on a multi-billion dollar industry, which is now going in a lot of different directions?
That's a broad question that I could spend an hour and a half, you know, discussing with you. But I would say clearly the major change happened the day that music got digitized. Okay. And that essentially led to everything else. I'll tell you an interesting moment that I can remember from way back in the day, and that is Mercury Records was part of Polygram, and Polygram was owned primarily by the Dutch company Philips, and Philips was the inventor of the compact disc. So there came a time that we were all, the A&R department, we were all called into a meeting, and there was a couple of guys in long white lab coats there to present to us this new sound carrier, the compact disc, and to tell us what a massive, wonderful, important breakthrough this was for music reproduction. And so they demonstrated it for us and talked about all the wonderful things that were going to come of it. And as an A&R executive, I sat there thinking, hang on a minute. They were proud of saying, these are perfect copies of the master tape, perfect copies. I stuck my little paw up in the air and I said, well, hang on a minute. The only thing that separates us from everybody else is that we have the master tapes. And you're suggesting that you're going to put a perfect copy of the master tapes in thousands of record stores around the world? And they said, yes, and it will be wonderful because it is the compact disc. That was, for me, a moment in time that was the demarcation line. And, you know, eventually what emerged from that was the era of Napster and the collapse of all finances in the record business. And then what led on from there was the decentralization of gatekeeping. The record labels were no longer in charge of, you know, what got released and how and when. And suddenly there was oceans of albums by people that some should and some shouldn't have been making albums. And the whole industry got very chaotic. Now, over the years, obviously, it's all been sorted out and streaming came along and all the energy that went into rectifying the situation. But that's my rough take on, you know, the evolution of the business. Now the revenues are back up and everybody is somewhat happy. I wouldn't say exceedingly happy, but that's what the industry had to go through to come out on the other side.
From your perspective, how have things changed in the way that music is being presented on college campuses? There's bands that come in and come out. The venues are all different now. Jorgensen does its performances. The students kind of do their own thing. Is it still the place to go for music on college campuses? Because I know, I guess it was the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, that bands like REM could spring up from colleges, which you don't really see a lot of that anymore. At least I don't think.
I'm going to have to agree with you. First of all, if I think back on the last 20 years, I can't think of that many shows that have taken in on college campuses. I don't know if that's a function of less touring acts, you know, capable of sustaining themselves on the road, you know, in an economic sense, or a lesser interest in the kind of bands that play live versus what kids might be into that don't translate to college dates as well.
Well, it seems that everything has to be a big visual splash more than the music itself, which was the main thing that, you know, we started getting from the era of Madonna, when the show itself became the spectacle and the music, well, that was kind of the backdrop to watch the show. You know, that's kind of the MTV effect.
Right. Times and tastes change, that's for sure. The other night, I got as far as Sabrina Carpenter dancing around some sort of baggage claim area. And I thought, what is this all coming to? It's unbelievable. So, as I say, tastes and times change.